The Tin Roof Blues, performed by the Billy Kretschmer Sextet, and Billy Kretschmer will be with us in just a moment on Fresh Air. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll hear from anthropologist Colin Turnbull, whose best-known book, The Forest People, is a study of pygmy culture. In his latest book, The Human Cycle, Turnbull compares his own upbringing in England with childhood and adolescence in the societies he studied in Africa and England. At about 3:40 today, film critic Ed Wiener will review Woody Allen's new film Zelig and Risky Business. In the 1930s and 40s and 50s in Philadelphia, the place to hear swing musicians jam after hours was Billy Kretschmer's Club at 1627 Ransted Street in Center City, between Market and Chestnut Streets. Musicians like Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, and Louis Armstrong would show up when they were in town. Before opening his club in 1938, Kretschmer toured with big bands. Red Nichols, Gene Krupa, and Glenn Miller were some of the sidemen he played with. This was before they led bands of their own. Throughout the 30 years the club was opened, Kretschmer led and performed in the house band, and that was a sextet. About 17 years ago, Kretschmer developed a hand condition that made it impossible for him to play. He closed the club in 1966 and retired and moved to Longport, New Jersey, where he continues to reside. Recently, he regained hand movement through surgery, but dental problems continue to prevent him from playing. Successful oral surgery has just remedied that problem. On August 28th, Billy Kretschmer, who is now in his 70s, will perform a benefit concert for the South Jersey Regional Theater, on whose board of directors he serves. This will be the first time he's performed in 17 years. The benefit will be at the Gateway Playhouse on Summers Point in New Jersey. There he'll be reunited with some original Philadelphia members of his jazz club sextet. For more information, you can call area code 609-653-0553. That's area code 609-653-0553. Billy Kretschmer, welcome to Fresh Air. I've heard a lot about you through other musicians, and it's a pleasure to finally meet you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You were on the road with bands before opening the club. Why did you decide to open a club in Philadelphia?
Well, I guess you'd have to say that I'm a captain. I'm not an Indian. I like to be the leader, and I always felt that I could do the job better than anyone else. I guess it's a hang-up, I guess. And traveling on the road is most overexposed thing in the world. It's just terrible to try to live on the road with no sleep and drunken bus drivers and a variety of things. One-nighters are the toughest way to make a living, just tough.
Having played in so many clubs, were there things you knew you wanted in your own club?
Sure.
Like what?
Yeah. Well, for instance, in those days everybody smoked, and you weren't permitted to smoke on a bandstand. We had, in my place, we had smoking stands. Everybody was getting cancer fast. and we didn't wear dinner jackets. I just insisted on dark clothing with a foreign hand tie. Another thing which was, it just was a very casual, relaxed atmosphere. And I bought and probably repertoired some of the greatest men in the business. They had to be good to come to me, but when they left, they were better.
What kind of clubs were in Philadelphia at the time when you opened in 1938?
There were, on South Broad, there was Peps. That was on the jazz thing, but they had visiting groups. I was the only house band. Then there was up on the Blue Note on Ridge Avenue. That opened in the 40s. That was Lou's Moravian on Moravian Street. That was kind of a jazz, but there was just a piano. The singers, Bon Bon. Names in those days were just hot stuff, you know. That's it. That was the in-town section. And Saturday afternoons were the biggest thing, where we had jam sessions on Saturday afternoon. That's where we listened to the new talent, young people that wanted to... They aspired to be soloists. You know, there's a terrific difference between a sideman that sits and reads the charts and a guy that's the soloist. It's a whole new kind of a person, a guy with projection, talent, and lots of ego. Big ego. That's what it takes, a big ego.
Your club became famous for its jam sessions. When did you first organize them?
We started in the very beginning. That was, as a matter of fact, its original name was Jam Session. When I found out that people were listening to me, I put Billy Kretschmer's Jam Session. Then as the years went on, the Jam Session got smaller and Billy Kretschmer got larger. And then I did away with the Jam Session. That was a very hip word in the 30s. Now it's kind of been overplayed.
I guess you enjoyed having your name outside the club.
What else? Exactly. By all means.
How did the musicians find out about the jam sessions that you held? Because a lot of big names would show up.
Well, musicians run out a lot. They have this inner... I guess it's an inner society of their own. They have their own inside jokes. They have their own. They're very usually very clever and very funny, and they have difficulty putting up with peons, as we used to call them. You know, plebeians, the people that are just the 9-to-5ers. You know, and news like that travels fast. After they played with the charts and the discipline. And after they get done doing that, they want to let, especially the talented ones, they want to let it go. No music, no nothing. Let their imagination play. And that's what they used to do. I can remember, I'll never forget, when Harry James died recently. Harry had just gotten his band started in 1939. He was at the Ben Franklin, which was quite a hotel in those days, at 9th and Chestnut. And he was in the room there, and the boss insisted he play with a mute, which is terrible for a jazz musician. And I invited him to my club to play. And this is about, after he finished at 2, and so by the time we got swinging, my place had to be 4, and someone was walking through the City Hall Plaza, which is at least 2 blocks away, and I heard a trumpet, and they followed the trumpet. It was Harry James playing in my club. So that's what, it was just to get the air, you know, blow off the steam of the discipline of the evening.
So mostly musicians and big bands who wanted stretch out.
They wanted to play what they felt like playing.
How many listeners would be left by 2 in the morning when they start coming?
The hardcore, always the same ones, and they enjoyed it. That's where it went.
Were the jam sessions very competitive?
Yes. That's when it separated the men from the boys. When a guy knew that he was being outplayed, he just silently stole away. That was the end of him. There was no display of temperament. They just packed a horn up and then went away. That's all.
Any moments like that stand out in your memory?
Oh, yes. I don't think it would pay to mention. Some of my very dearest friends wouldn't have musicians always don't have good nights. Sometimes when you're up, I'm not speaking of just normal up, things don't work out the way they should. The guys are not playing the right tunes or the keys are wrong or something like that. And it's embarrassing. One guy, quite a man now, he's no longer, a terrific jazz trumpeter, was with the Ray McKinley Band. And Ray McKinley later took over the Glenn Miller Band. And he started to cry, the trumpeter, because he couldn't compete. Just was too tough for him. The heartbreak moment, you know, when suddenly the talent is not up to the standard that he hoped it would be. It's quite a thing.
Did you play in the jam sessions?
Oh, certainly. That was a part of the whole thing. Sure.
Did you feel competitive in it?
Yes. I played better for them than I would ordinarily. Sure. I worked harder. Musicians are a lot in that. They play for each other. And if you allow them to do it, they'll chase every good customer out of the place because they're acrobatics and stuff like that, which really don't sell. They don't sell.
Well, before we talk more about your career and your club, let's listen to another selection from one of the albums that you made. And we're going to listen to a piece that you wrote called The Ransted Street Parade, named after the street that your club was on in Philadelphia. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
It was something, there was a Rampart Street Parade, and I got jealous, and I thought, well, why not Ransted Street Parade? Rampart Street, of course, as you know, in New Orleans, and got a lot of notoriety, so I thought, let's talk about Ransted Street, that's all. As a matter of fact, you'll notice that particular record is called Ransted Label, just to publicize that name.
And that was your own label that you recorded on?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what year this was made in?
This is in the mid-60s, I would say between 62 and 64.
Okay, well, let's hear Billy Kretschmer leading his sextet, recorded in the mid-60s, Ransted Street Parade.
We'll be right back.
clarinetist Billy Kretschmer's Ranstead Street Parade, and Billy Kretschmer ran a very popular club for 30 years in Philadelphia, which opened in 1938. He retired from playing in 1966 when a physical problem in his hand made it impossible to play, but he's gotten that problem fixed up and had some dental problems fixed up, and will be playing his first performance in 17 years on August 28th at a benefit for the South Jersey Regional Theater. And for more information, you can call area code 609-653-0553. So you had these late-night jam sessions whenever musicians were around to play. Were there any liquor laws or other codes in Philadelphia that you'd have to get around in order to pull this off successfully?
No, we had to do it all sotto voce, as they say. It had to be done under the cover. We didn't publicize it too much. As I said, a very closely knit group, our musicians, very closely knit. And it was a thing. It was a private thing, you know, where you could, these guys, after they were restricted by the discipline of the charts, and they could play extemporaneously and try things, and they love to try things. If it comes out good, great. If it doesn't, too bad. Like that. Well, musicians are basically, you know, it's an art. And playing jazz is an art. And it just happens to be everyone seems to make a big differentiation between serious music, which we just listened to on the program before this, you know, the chamber music and symphonic music, and which is definitely music. But the notes are identical. It's only the mood in which they're played. That's all it is. But the notation is identical.
But did you ever have to do creative things to get around the existing codes and laws to keep the club open that late to serve alcohol?
Yes, creative things. That's a good word. I'll use that. Yes.
Do you care to share any or...
Well, there were certain people that could help you do that. You know, if it was done, we put the lights out and locked the door and didn't admit any more people. But if we were having fun, I didn't make a thing out. But if we were having fun, we just locked the door and nobody was admitted and we just had our little ball in there. Nobody ever said anything because it was a private thing.
Did that change over the years?
Yes. It became more and more stringent. It was taken for granted that you were doing something wrong rather than just playing. That's what's happened to our whole society, unfortunately.
What was the toughest period?
After World War II. That's when things really got tight. We had an influx of new kinds of people, and that's when I noticed it got tougher and tougher.
What made it hard?
Well, to operate a clean place was difficult. We had to put just security, you know, somebody on the door to keep the riffraff out and drunks out. Never had that problem before. But that seems to be a growing situation.
When the performers from big bands came to play after hours at your place, where were they playing during their regular performances?
At the Earl Theater. That was the home of the big bands. That was at 11th and Market, which has been torn down. And then I was at 16th. So it was a short cab. We had the cab drivers lined up and get the cabs, a couple of independent cabs, they load in, come over, and that's the way we did that. But now that we're on Market Street in the 30s, there was a Massbaum Theater at 20th and Market. There was a Stanley Theater at 19th and Market. At 21st and Market was the Erlanger Theater. These were all torn down. At 16th and Market was a Fox Theater. Now all of these theaters had house bands. 40, 50, 60 men in them. Then down at 11th and Market was the Earl Theater. Imagine, this was Market Street alone. Nothing is left. So that has taken away a lot of the work potential of the musician. He's rather restricted. It's hard. It's very difficult. If he's not first-class caliber and has eyes for symphonic work, like the Philadelphia Orchestra, he's got to be first-class caliber. And how many are there? In the woodwind section, you've got top 8 or 9 people. So it's not easy. And as I said, the work potential has been just cut to pieces, and it's really a shame. It really is.
When those theaters closed, were there musicians in town to come to your sessions?
Oh, sure. They were, you know, they looked for a hip joint, you know, someplace that knew what was going on with a player. You'd be surprised at music is music, you know, but
Were there big name musicians in town? Where would they have
Well,
lived?
Sometimes they came to clubs after that. They did come. Peps stayed a while after that. They had some names there. And there was a place on Lombard Street. It was called a Showboat, which I didn't mention before. That changed names after that and ultimately closed. Pepsi's closed. There isn't a, to my knowledge, I'm not a Philadelphian anymore, but the kind of club that I ran is non-existent anymore. That's what's happened, unfortunately.
How does it compare, do you think, with the clubs that exist now?
Oh, it's hard to compare. First of all, a drink in 1966, when I closed, a drink of the best, which spoke about scotch, Chivas Regal, 12-year-old, was $1.25. Now I paid $4.50 for it. So this is, it's all on a different level. And it's, unfortunately, but our whole existence is different. Parking your car. You have to get a mortgage to get your car off the parking lot. That's what's happened.
Was there a lot of fragmentation when your club was open in the jazz audience, either racially or by the 50s, between the people who wanted to hear swing and who wanted to hear...
No, there was no racial overtones in the business itself. I never felt that at all. I never felt that. There was no religious overtones like there are in some areas of employment. An artist is an artist, regardless if he could be blue or he could be whatever, a Muslim or whatever. He would be accepted if he has the talent. He must have the talent. But that automatically makes him acceptable. That's what, that's it.
So in the business itself, you didn't think there were divisions, but what about in the audiences?
Oh, yeah. Oh, always. That prejudice is, it's just impossible to beat it, you know, without knowing about it. It's just like rooting for your home team. Without even knowing, you suddenly say, ooh, I want them to win, and you don't know why. That's what it is. That's the way we're made up.
Who are some of the people who came to your club to play before they were famous?
Well, after, I know most of them, like, I had Slam Stewart with me. He was with Benny Goodman for quite a while. He was with me for a year, an outstanding talent. I had so many good people. The trumpet players, Max Kaminsky, I came out of New York. Conrad Jones out of New Orleans, they were in my group. Charlie McPartland, Jack Teagarden and I were dear friends, and we exchanged. He was interested, not financially, but in a place in the Village in New York, and he said if he would come to my club for a week, I would go to his, and we didn't ever exchange money. The biggest important people, and the bigger they are and the better they play, the nicer they are, as a rule.
Were there ever any problems doing business with musicians who
yes.
you were also friends with?
They're broke all the time. Broke. Apparently broke. That's the name of the game.
Well, how did you try to play it between wanting to do favors for friends and wanting to, you know, keep your business in the black?
I gave away most of it.
In the black or the red? It's in the black, right? Yeah.
Yeah, black. I to them, the guys that played there, I just gave everything away. I never charged. It was a friendship thing. I would have the same amount of courtesy given if I were someplace else. When I used to go over to Eddie Conlon, had a successful jazz room in the Village in New York, and I never paid a check there, nor did he when he came to my place. It was a reciprocal situation, and I enjoyed going there, and I'm sure he enjoyed coming to my place. But that's the way we operate. As I said, they're a funny group.
Yeah, I guess there was no other business between you since they were jamming in their off hours.
Oh, sure. There was no competitive feeling there at all. Two different cities. And of course, he was in New York. It's quite a difference in the New York listening audience. The prices, of course, even in those days, were twice as much as we. I was competitive with the bars in the area.
What was the inside of your club like?
Was like the perimeter was completely in wrought iron. It was a balcony on the second floor. That was kind of a New Orleans touch. It was most of the perimeter was covered by the balcony, and a lot of wrought iron work. I kind of liked that. And the bandstand faced the entrance. I could stand and see the bartenders, two bartenders on that side, and I could see the entrance to the door where the hostess used to do the seating. The only thing I couldn't see was one of the service bars in the back that took care of the upstairs part. And I got my reports on that, and that's what I wanted. I was able to hold everything.
Yeah, how'd you play on the bandstand and figure out what was happening in your club at the same time?
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy, but it was fun. I don't think I could do it now. I really don't. But then, it was a joy. And it was a question about smarting people, you know. I know I was there every night, and I enjoyed what I did, and we had, as a rule, a very good listening audience. And many times I would guy came to tell jokes, you know, and I said, well, this is not a place to tell jokes. We didn't sing and we didn't dance. We just played music. And if you didn't enjoy music, the best thing is to go home. And I would tell him, and I, don't pay the check, but don't come back again. Please don't come back again.
Did you have something against dancing and singing?
No, but if we allowed them to sing, first of all, we had no room for dancing. I needed seats there. If we allowed them to sing, Philadelphia has it has an entertainment tax. So that knocked that out, and I didn't want to pay the entertainment tax. I didn't advertise. The only time I had a radio program practically all the time I was in business, and I used to do jazz shows. I would get celebrities like, you know, you're doing now, and intersperse that with their records and talk about personal little vignettes that happened, and so that I used that for my publicity. So I didn't use a newspaper, and I didn't use a... I just had one New Yorker I ran one small ad in the New Yorker, and it just said, stuck in Philadelphia, ? Billy Kretschmer didn't say what we did, but that's all.
Did it work?
Yes.
How do you know?
Well, people would come and talk about it. Yeah, it was an expensive ad. New York is expensive.
I didn't know about your radio show. What station was it on?
I was on WPBS for 3 years, and they just asked me about this cover here, and back there you'll see Kretschmer, WQUAL, and that was an FM. I did that, and I was on... Another one. Practically all the time that I was open, I was on radio, just once a week, taped. And my producer was Bill Mowbray, and he would line up if he would help to line up some of the people. If I had difficulty in getting them to come to Philadelphia, or they weren't busy, I would send them a tape. They would make, and then we would clip the tape and intersperse some music and so forth.
You played a club owner in a film based on Charlie Parker's life called Sweet Love Bitter, and also in On the Town with a score by Leonard Bernstein.
How
did you get those roles?
I don't know. I just played the rabbi in Fiddler on the Roof for the South Jersey Regional Theater, and I did Mr. Gibbs in Arsic and Old Lace.
Did the producers or directors or casting directors know you already as a club owner?
Yeah. But acting is just like playing. It's projection. If you have a line, you get it out. You get it out.
Do you think that they thought that was something about you that was the prototypical club owner?
Probably. Yes. Probably. Yeah. And they made most of that movie right in my play. It could have been a terrific movie.
Which movie?
This Bitter.
Sweet Love Bitter? Was shot in your necklace?
It was called, firstly, many pictures are changed, the names are changed, but this was called, if I recall correctly, because my contract was signed with Night Song. And then there seemed to be a problem with Charlie Parker's widow, and they changed the name for it. But by it looked to me like the editing was poor, and the movie never got really off the ground. Don Murray was in it, Dick Gregory, Denise Darcel. It was a good cast. It was interesting. Very good.
Yeah, I've seen the record, I think, from the soundtrack of it, but I've never seen the movie. You haven't played in over 17 years. I guess you had a hand problem that...
Yes, yeah.
Is that when you decided to close the club?
I closed the club on account of it. I wasn't enjoying my work. I couldn't even last the whole night through. 5 hours used to be a pipe with me, but it became difficult. And I went back for more surgery. And Dr. James Hunter, the premier hand surgeon in the country, maybe the world. He's right in Philadelphia. I just saw he was on television. He did another unbelievable operation with a hand. From here to here, in other words, this is not in it. It's just from the elbow
to the wrist.
Right. And he did most of the surgery, although he did not do my carpal tunnel. Maybe I'd have been better.
So you didn't want to stay in the club if you couldn't play?
Oh, yes, I would be. I couldn't. If I didn't have things under control, I couldn't work. I'm not that type.
Well, between the hand surgery that was successful and recent oral surgery, you're able to play again. Have you been practicing?
Oh, unbelievably. Yeah, just like a little boy, starting from scratch all over.
What's it like to pick up an instrument after 7, especially clarinet, which is very
suffering.
Hard.
It's suffering, lots of suffering. Sure, clarinet is a challenge. I was just interviewed before this, and this person, a very knowledgeable guy, said, what does your clarinet say to you? It says, I dare you. That's what it says. I dare you, because it's a very difficult instrument. It has no, you see, it doesn't have keys. It have holes that must be covered. And if they're not, it's not like a saxophone where it has a key and a pad and, you know, it covers itself. This has got to be touched physically.
When you stopped playing, did you find that it was hard to listen to music since you couldn't play it yourself?
Yeah. I didn't listen. It got me very depressed. This record I just heard, I hadn't heard it since it was made. So, sure, it's a depressing thing.
Did you find something else to fill in?
I play piano.
Uh-huh.
And I do a lot of woodwork. I have a workshop at home. But I like to play clarinet.
I know you were a student at Curtis. How did you start playing?
Well, my teacher, I was studying saxophone with a teacher. And I guess he thought there was something different about me. And he said, why don't you... Curtis, there was nothing but scholarships. You can't pay for Curtis, or you couldn't. I don't think you can yet. So he said, why don't you take an examination for a scholarship? I said, really? He said, yeah, you can do it. So I went, and I got it. I stayed there for over 3 years. They weren't accredited at that time to give any degrees. I think they are now. But I did have the best instructor in the world and the best... the environment was so good for me. Just my kind of people. It was good.
On August 28th, when you play for the first time in 17 years, you'll be reunited with some of the people who you played with in your club. Who are some of those people, and what have they been doing since?
Well, to start off, the trumpeter, which happens to be on this album, was with me for about 8 years. He's a professional musician. There's no avocation connected with these people. I don't believe in that. I think it's a full-time job. The trombone player, McAdams, who will be with me, has, I don't believe, made any records with me, because some of the original boys, Charles Borneman, is down south, the other guy's out in Vegas. But full-time musician. Andy Boyd, drummer, full-time musician. And it's not easy. Eddie Evans, the pianist, is out of Drexelbrook, working at Drexelbrook, as a musician, of course. Chet Fry is up in upstate Pennsylvania as a musician. They're all professionals.
Well, good luck with that concert. I'm glad you're playing again.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you for talking with us today and telling us about your club.
My pleasure, of course.
Wish I was in Philadelphia in time to have seen it. I moved here after it closed.
Try to make the concert, and you'll hear things that'll be different.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, dear.
Billy Kretschmer has been my guest, and from 1938 to 1966, he ran a very popular nightclub in Philadelphia called Billy Kretschmer's. And he'll be performing for the first time in 17 years. This month, it's August 28th, and this will be a benefit performance for the South Jersey Regional Theater. He serves on the board of directors of that group. And for more information, you can call area code 609-653-0553. Again, that's area code 609-653-0553. And the performance will be held at the Gateway Playhouse on Summers Point in New Jersey. This is Fresh Air. It's 27 minutes to 4 o'clock. Coming up in about 5 minutes, Ed Wiener will be reviewing two films, Woody Allen's latest, Zelig, and also Risky Business. Before we do that, we're going to listen to another recording from the album Billy Kretschmer has brought with him today. And we'll be hearing at the Jazz Band Ball. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
At the Jazz Band, it's one of the Dixieland classics. And it was put together by the Dixieland Jazz Band, which was one of the original things. And it's a kind of a foot-tapping thing. You'll enjoy it.
Okay, let's hear it. The jazz band Ball with the Billy Kretschmer Sextet is recorded in the 1960s with Billy Kretschmer on clarinet. And again, he'll be performing in a benefit concert on August 28th at the Gateway Playhouse on Summers Point in New Jersey, and it's a benefit for the South Jersey Regional Theater. For more information, you can call area code 609-653-0553. Coming up at about 4 o'clock today, we'll be hearing from our archives an interview with anthropologist Colin Turnbull. First, film critic Ed Wiener reviews two movies, Risky Business and Woody Allen's new film, Zelig.
Well, Terry, a funny thing happened to me on my way to the movies this week.